Ladies and gentlemen, I want to begin this lecture by reading a certain number of two or three extracts from different authors, which will cast a lot of light, I think, on the subject I propose to discuss. The first extract is from the autobiography of Helen Keller, where she describes how she discovered language as a child. She writes, "My teacher brought me my hat, and I knew we were going out into the warm sunshine. The thought, if a wordless sensation can be called a thought, made me leap and skip for joy. We walked down the path to the well house. Someone was drawing water, and my teacher placed my hand under the spout. As the cool stream gushed over my hand, she spelled into the other the word water, first slowly, then rapidly. Suddenly, I felt a misty consciousness, as of something forgotten, a thrill of returning thought, and somehow the mystery of language was revealed to me. I knew then that water meant the wonderful cool something that was flowing over my hand. That living word awakened my soul, gave it light, hope, joy, set it free. I left the well house eager to learn. Everything had a name, and each name gave birth to a new thought. As we returned to the house, every object which I touched seemed to quiver with life. That was because I saw everything with the strange new sight that had come to me." Now, against this, let us set a number of other quotations. Let me set, first of all, some quotations from Goethe. Goethe, after all, was one of the supreme masters of the word, and it is very interesting to find this great manipulator of words speaking constantly against language. He says in one place, "Gefühl ist alles, Name ist Schall und Rauch. Feeling is everything, name is mere sound and smoke." And then there's the famous quotation, "Grau, teurer Freund, ist alle Theorie und grün des Lebens goldner Baum." Gray is all theory, green life's golden tree. And in another, it's in one of his letters, I think, he says a very curious remark about speaking and drawing. "We talk too much. We should talk less and draw more. I personally should like to renounce speech altogether and, like organic nature, communicate everything I have to say in sketches. That fig tree, this little snake, the cocoon on my windowsill, quietly awaiting its future. All these are momentous signatures. Indeed, a person able to decipher their meaning properly would soon be able to dispense with spoken and written words altogether. The more I think of it, there is something futile, mediocre, even foppish about speech." And here is another poet, the Elizabethan poet Drayton, who has a beautiful passage on the speakable and the unspeakable in relation to poetry. "They are the smallest pieces of the mind that pass the narrow organ of the voice. The great remain behind in that vast orb of the apprehension and are never born." So much for the poets, the masters of the word. And now let's come to one of the great masters of practical life, Talleyrand, the great French diplomatist of the beginning of the 19th century. What he says of language is that the function of words is to conceal thought, which was undoubtedly true in his case. And there's another very interesting remark about language, which is expressed by the great Christian existentialist philosopher Kierkegaard, where he says, I believe that the purpose of language is to assist and confirm people in refraining from action. This, after all, is in a sense a development of the phrase in the Gospel which says, not all of those who say, Lord, Lord, shall enter into heaven. That what is required is not devotion or theological speculation, but the right action. On the other hand, we find that language can be most horribly effective in promoting action, especially bad action. Let us listen to what Hitler has to say in relation to language as a promoter of bad action. To be effective, he wrote, propaganda must confine itself to a few very simple ideas expressed in a few stereotyped formulas constantly repeated. Now let us consider language in relation to religion. We find a number of remarks about this in the epistles of St. Paul. And the remarks, of course, are all the more curious when one reflects that it is precisely the language of St. Paul's epistles which has dominated the whole Christian scene for 1900 years. He says within the well-known phrase, the letter killeth, but the spirit giveth life. And he says again, we should serve in the newness of the spirit and not in the oldness of the letter. And we come to the great mystics of the Middle Ages, and we find Meister Eckhart saying, why do you prate about God? Whatever you say about him is untrue. And here is a passage in relation of language, in relation to philosophy, a passage from the works of John Locke. It was written nearly 300 years ago, but is still very, very much to the point. He says, vague and insignificant forms of speech and abuse of language have so long passed for mysteries of science and hard or misapplied words have by prescription such a right to be mistaken for deep learning and height of speculation that it will not be easy to persuade either those who speak or those who hear them, that they are but the covers of ignorance and a hindrance to true knowledge. Well, these quotations from Helen Keller on the one hand and from these various authors on the other indicate very clearly the curiously ambivalent attitude towards language which we always have had, which we certainly still have, and which has prevailed throughout the ages. The phrase which opens the Gospel according to St. John is, in the beginning was the Word. Now this, in regard to the beginning of the strictly human world, is perfectly true. There is no doubt at all that the strictly human form of life arose when language developed, when it was possible for man to speak. Language is what makes us human. Unfortunately, it is also what makes us all too human. It is, on the one hand, the mother of science and philosophy. On the other hand, it begets every kind of superstition and prejudice and madness. It helps us in one way, in another way it destroys us. It makes civilization possible, and it also produces those frightful conflicts which wreck civilization. So that when we examine the whole history of this strange, specifically human gift, we always find these two sides of language going on and exercising their beneficent or destructive influence. Now, human behavior differs from animal behavior precisely because of the fact that human beings can speak and animals cannot. And we find that even the most intelligent animals, because they cannot speak, cannot do things which to us would seem absolutely rudimentary, which very small children would be, probably, as soon as they learn to talk, would be able to accomplish. There was a very interesting experiment carried out by the great German Gestalt psychologist Kohler, who worked for many years with chimpanzees. Kohler found that his chimpanzees could use sticks as tools to pull down bananas which were hanging out of their reach. They were intelligent enough to see that this tool here, the stick, could be used for extending their arm and getting the banana down from the ceiling. But he found that this was possible only when the stick and the banana were both in view of the animals at the same time. If the banana was in front of them and the stick was behind, they could not use the stick. They couldn't bear in mind the banana long enough to look round and pick up the stick and then use it. And the reason is, I think, quite clear. We can do this because we have words for banana and stick, which permit us to think about these objects when they are not actually in sight. That even a small child, knowing the words banana and stick, he has a conceptual notion of their relationship, and is consequently able to think of stick in relation to banana, even when the stick is behind him, and to remember this long enough to pick the stick up, and use it on the bananas. This accounts, of course, for the strangely preposterous behavior of animals in many situations. The fact that they cannot keep up their interest and their knowledge of things over a long period. Now, in another way, animals differ profoundly from human beings, in as much as their life is profoundly intermittent. There seems to be no sort of coherence in their life. They constantly interrupt one line of action to do something else and come back to it or forget it altogether. Whereas human beings, thanks to language, are able to pursue one purpose or to act in relation to a principle or to an ideal over long periods of time. In a certain sense, we can say that language is a device for permitting human beings to do in cold blood the good and the evil, which it is possible for animals to do only when the blood is warm. The human being can perform feats of angelic virtue over a long period of time precisely because he is constantly motivated by ideals, urged forward by principles in the form of words, and he can also behave with absolutely diabolic cruelty and stupidity by being motivated by bad ideals and by stupid forms of words, so that he can behave both much better and much worse than animals. And of course, this is one of the great paradoxes of the human species, that we can be angels, which animals can never be. But we can also be devils, which animals can never be. And both these extraordinary gifts are due to the fact that we use language and that we are guided by these concepts which we have in our head, which permit us, in Matthew Arnold's words, he says that tasks in hours of insight willed may be in hours of gloom fulfilled. And these tasks may be either good tasks or bad tasks, and they are fulfillable in hours of gloom simply because of the fact that we have language and the animals don't. The animals, as I say, are profoundly intermittent, and we have a purpose. Now, this continuity is illustrated not merely in the life of individual human beings, it is illustrated also very forcibly in the life of entire societies. In this case, a language may be described as a device for connecting the present with the past and the future. In the discussion which followed the Darwin lectures, it was made very clear that the Lamarckian conception of the inheritance of acquired characteristics is, of course, completely unacceptable, untrue biologically. But on the social and psychological and linguistic level, it is perfectly true. Language does provide us a means for taking advantage of the fruits of past experience. There is such a thing as social heredity, the acquisitions of our ancestors are handed on to us through written and spoken language, and we do therefore enjoy the possibility of inheriting acquired characteristics, not through the germplasm, but through tradition, which is, of course, embodied mainly in language and also to some extent in other symbol systems. And unfortunately, of course, tradition can hand on both bad as well as good items. It can hand on prejudices and superstitions just as effectively as it can hand on science and decent ethical codes. And here again we see this strange ambivalence of this extraordinary gift. It's like in the fairy stories where there's the good fairy and the bad fairy. But in this case, the good fairy's gift, which is this amazing gift of language, turns out also to be the bad fairy's gift. I mean, this is one of the strange ironies of our destiny, that this wonderful thing we have, which Helen Keller so eloquently describes as this giver of life and creator of thought, is also one of the most dangerous and destructive things that we can have. Now, let us now for a moment consider what happened before the word. In the beginning was the word, in the beginning of human life, as a strictly human adventure, there undoubtedly was the word, there was language. Now, what precisely happens where there is no language, happens in relation to very small children, and above all, in relation to animals? What is the life of what may be called immediate experience without a language? Here, it is worth making a small digression in relation to some of the ideas of Indian philosophy. The Indian philosophers have always affirmed that the thing which creates our specifically human world is what they call nama rupa, name and form, a sort of hyphenated name and form. Name may be defined as a subjectivized form, and form is the projection of name into the outer world, and the two between them create for human beings this world of separate objects existing in time. Now, the enlightened individual, the man who has attained enlightenment, goes beyond grammar. He has a what may be called a grammar transcending experience, which permits him to live in the consciousness of the divine continuum of the world, and to see the one continually manifest in the many. And this is the nature of the experience, I think, of the enlightened person. And this is a subject which there will be more, I shall have more to talk about when we come to the problems of religion in its various various forms. Meanwhile, let us get back to this problem of what happens before the rise of language. The enlightened person is, so to speak, after the rise of language. He lives in language and then goes beyond it. But before language has been introduced, what sort of a world is the world of immediate non-verbalized experience? Well, William James spoke of the world of immediate experience in very characteristic phrase as a blooming, buzzing confusion. The idea being that the animal and the small child lived in this chaos of sensations. Well, recent investigations in the ethology of animals and the perceptions of small children have revealed that immediate experience really isn't quite as blooming and as buzzing as William James supposed. The thing which is, I think, emerged most strikingly from recent scientific developments is that, of course, that perception is not a passive reception of material from the outside world. It is an active process of selection and of imposing patterns. And we find that the nervous system of animals and, as we shall see later on, of human beings, is contrived in such a way that it automatically sifts out from the blooming, buzzing confusion those elements which are biologically useful. So far as animals are concerned, it selects out of the confusion precisely those elements which help it to survive. The animal really sees only two classes of objects, the edible and the dangerous. And one of the things which has been revealed in the study of animal universes is how extraordinarily limited they are and how extremely odd many of them are. The great German biologist von Uexküll wrote a great deal on this subject, on the subject of what he called the Umwelt of animals, the different universes in which creatures of different classes and species lived. And the subject is one of immense fascination. It makes one realize how extremely arbitrary our idea of reality is. We have an idea of reality, of course, incomparably greater than that of even the highest of the lower animals. But even then, goodness knows what a creature with more effective senses and a better mind than ours, what sort of a world it would live in. As an example of the strangeness of some of these animal universes, let me cite the case of the frog, which was communicated to me recently by Dr. Wall of MIT. I hadn't read about it, but he told me about it. Apparently, the recent researches on frogs indicate that the frog, which has extremely mechanically very good eyes, sees in a very limited way. Evidently, the buzzing, blooming confusion comes in at its eyes. But what the frog actually perceives, what its nervous system selects out of the innumerable sensa which come in, is very limited indeed. The frog apparently sees only that which moves. So that one can imagine a frog sitting on a water lily leaf and looking down into the water, and there is a minnow swimming. And as long as the minnow swims, the frog sees it. The minnow stands still for a little and immediately apparently disappears from the frog's universe. So that And then when it starts swimming again, it enters into the world once more and goes on. So that the frog's universe must be unutterably strange. It must be a continuous emergence and disappearance of objects, which if it could reflect upon this, I mean, what on earth its philosophy would be, the metaphysics of appearance and disappearance. I mean, there may be frog Platos, for all we know, who have devised the most extraordinary systems to account for this fantastic fact. And the even much more limited universes, of course, belong to animals of a lower level of organization than the frog. And even animals as high as dogs and monkeys quite clearly have entirely different kinds of universes from what we have. I mean, they just don't notice certain things which to us are very important. I mean, one looks at one's dog and he obviously doesn't notice the sunset, which to us seems very beautiful, or the flowers on the tree. I mean, he just smells the trunk of the tree and finds something very satisfactory there. But as for looking up at the flowers, no, never. Well, now when we come to human beings, we find that, again, the nervous system does select from the buzzing, blooming confusion in the same way that the animal nervous system selects, but it doesn't select anything like as rigorously. Much more comes through to consciousness than ever comes through to the animal, even to the higher animals. An enormous, much greater range of reality enters the human mind. And there is a great profusion of material, and the profusion does, I think here James is quite right, that the profusion is sufficiently great, even in spite of the neurological selection and abstraction which has gone on, that the profusion is confusion, that we are, as it comes in, we are confused by this mass of material. And here is where language, of course, comes in, that we can go further with the process of selection and abstraction by means of language. We proceed to a higher level of abstraction by means of language, and select in this conscious and semi-conscious or pre-conscious way those materials which are useful to us biologically, and since we are not entirely at the mercy of our biological necessities, those materials which are interesting to us for various reasons and valuable socially or valuable from the point of view of aesthetics or whatnot. So that from the first then, we see that that human beings, over and above what their nervous system does to select from the mass of items coming in from the outside world, performs these acts of abstraction. And these acts of abstraction are immediately the materials which we derive through this abstraction are immediately translated into symbols. That we have this, evidently, this innate tendency to turn all our experiences into more or less equivalent symbols. Well, these symbols, of course, may be non-verbal of many varieties, but clearly by far the most important symbol system, the most highly organized, is language. And we immediately turn these confusing materials into a series of symbols which we can understand. I shall develop this subject a little further when we come to consider art, but I think let's say it here, that that we have a kind of innate urge to order and meaning, and it is through language that we impose symbolic order and symbolic meaning upon a profusion which, as it is apprehended directly, seems to us terribly confusing. Now, this process of abstraction and selection is in many cases extremely useful to us from a biological point of view. In fact, it's quite clear we just couldn't get on without it. It is useful to us biologically, indirectly, it is useful to us as scientists, as technologists in our efforts to control environment. It is useful to us as social beings. But again, here we come once more to this ambivalence of the linguistic and symbol-making process. We go much beyond the biologically or socially useful, and we very often make up symbol systems which are not merely unhelpful, but maybe extraordinarily dangerous and destructive to us. That it's really just as easy for us to impose order and meaning upon immediate experience. You see, it's just as easy for us to impose bad order and bad meaning as to impose good order and good meaning. And we find this constantly happening in the world. We enjoy this process of symbolization and of expressing our symbols. It is as though there was a kind of art for art's sake in this procedure. But we very often find that in our enthusiasm for imposing order and meaning through symbols upon immediate experience, we have made an awful mess of the experience and created a symbol pattern which leads us into endless trouble. Worth quoting a few examples of this urge to order and meaning which has somehow gone astray. For example, one of the areas in which human beings have tried to impose their own kind of order and meaning is the area of astronomy. Man has, of course, from earliest times looked up at the heavenly bodies, the sun, the moon, the planets, and the stars, and has been puzzled, as anybody in heaven knows, maybe puzzled by this extraordinary mystery of existence. But he has tried to impose upon this this mystery an order and a meaning which makes sense to him as an all-too-human being. And in many cases, as we see from a study of history, he has made profound mistakes in regard to the order and meaning of the heavenly bodies, and mistakes which have cost him very dearly in his social and individual life. Let us consider a single example. Man's attitude towards eclipses. Well, these have, from time immemorial, eclipses have been regarded as extraordinarily dangerous events, portents which foretold disasters. They've been felt to be in some way closely connected with human life, and always in an extremely dangerous way. Now, let me cite one of the most interesting examples of the danger of trying to impose the wrong kind of order and meaning upon cosmic events. On the what was the date? On the 27th of August, 413 BC, there was an eclipse of the moon. Now, this eclipse of the particular eclipse of the moon was of great historical importance because it was observed by Nicias and the Athenians, who were at the time besieging Syracuse in Sicily. They'd been in considerable trouble, and it was quite clear that they ought to go home and that they would probably get into much worse trouble if they stayed on. But an eclipse was profoundly unlucky in the symbol system of the Athenians, that governed the Athenian mind. In their search for order and meaning in the universe, they had made this decision that this sort of thing was extremely dangerous, that a journey should never be started in the neighborhood of an eclipse. And consequently, Nicias decided to postpone the return to Athens for at least a month. The decision was taken, and the consequence was that his entire fleet was destroyed, and his entire army was taken prisoner by the Syracusans, and which indicates how extremely dangerous it is to have wrong views about the cosmos. If you have this hunger and thirst for order and meaning and are not patient enough to look into the real nature of the order and meaning, but insist that the universe shall mean things in terms of your all too human wishes and desires, you will certainly get into trouble. A similar example of the extreme danger of having turned the universe into the wrong kind of symbols was illustrated by the Aztecs. They too wanted to make some kind of sense and order of the celestial phenomena, and they concentrated primarily upon the sun, as well they might, which is by far the most important object in our universe. But unfortunately, they anthropomorphized the sun and felt that that in order to keep alive, the sun must be constantly fed. And one of the things that they thought the sun needed was the blood of sacrificial victims. And as anybody who's read Aztec history knows, they had this peculiarly unpleasant method of sacrifice of ripping the heart out of the victim and holding it up to the sun. Well, the necessity of providing the sun with a continual supply of human blood imposed upon the Aztecs the foreign policy of continuously raiding their neighbors for victims. They would send their armies out into the neighboring territories. They did their best not to kill the people in battles, but to take them alive. And they would bring them back to Mexico City and sacrifice them at the rate of about 20,000 a year. Needless to say, this procedure did not make them very popular with their neighbors. So that when the Spaniards arrive, a great many of the neighbors of the Aztec kingdom went onto the side of the Spaniards. And this accounts, of course, for the almost miraculous success of Cortes and his tiny band in overthrowing the Aztec Empire. And these two examples make it very clear how dangerous it is to try to impose symbolic order and meaning upon the world before you really understand what the world is like. Nevertheless, we shall always do this because it is very difficult for human beings to tolerate the mysterious as such. I mean, what the theologian Otto calls the mysterium tremendum of the world. Man has never been able to put up with this. It is so terrible and so inexplicable that he has always had to put up this smokescreen of symbols between himself and the tremendous mystery of life. I mean, in one of its functions, it may be said that language is a device for taking mysteriousness out of mystery. We've always done this, and unquestionably in the future times, the historians will see that we are still doing it, perhaps not as flagrantly as the Aztecs or the Greeks did it, but probably very badly. And this tendency to impose premature and order and meaning upon the universe is very clearly illustrated in the culture of the Middle Ages. Let me quote a few lines from the great French historian of medieval art, Émile Malle, who says, "In the Middle Ages, the idea of a thing, the idea of a thing, was always more real than the thing itself. The study of things for their own sake held no meaning for thoughtful men. The task for the student of nature was to discover the eternal truth which God would have each thing express." Now, we may ask ourselves, what were the eternal truths expressed by individual things? They were, in fact, not the laws of nature, not the truths of physics and chemistry, the generalizations based upon the humble observation of facts, because they were simply not interested in the humble observation of facts. They were only interested, really, in illustrating in the external world something that they had read in books which they regarded as authoritative, either in the scriptures or in the Greek philosophers whom they regarded as authorities. We may say that the proper relationship between words and things had been reversed during the whole of the Middle Ages. The proper relationship, I presume, is that words should be regarded as arbitrary symbols standing for things. But the men of the Middle Ages looked at it the other way round. They regarded things as standing for words, as being illustrations of some general abstract principle to be found in Aristotle or in some part of the scriptures. And as Marl says, the idea of the thing, which was something which had been taken out of a book, was much more real than the thing itself. And the result is that as one reads medieval literature, one begins by being, I think, highly entertained by this extraordinary phenomenon of allegorical botany, of parables in this in natural history, of an astronomy which tells fortunes. All these things begin, as I say, by being very entertaining. But in a very short while, certainly I speak for myself, one becomes terribly oppressed by this awful humanization of nature. One has a sense of being boxed in, being shut in into a world where everything has a suffocating feeling of humanity instead of being other than humanity. To use the phrase employed by Gerard Manley Hopkins, the medieval world is one where everything wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. There is this, one has a sense of being boxed up in a prison. Everything is so tight, so terribly anthropomorphic. And it was, of course, only when this reversal of the proper relationship between words and things was changed as a result of the new interest in science. The two things obviously go hand in hand, they're neither
the cause, each is a cause and each is an effect of the other. Only then do we enter a world where nature is refreshingly other than the all too human world. In our own time, we find that all the most horrifying aspects of contemporary life have arisen precisely from this wrong relationship between symbols and words. All the totalitarian tyrannies of our time have been based upon the wrong relation of things and words, that, as I say, words have not been regarded as symbols arbitrarily standing for things, but things have been regarded as illustrations of words. Take, for example, the whole Nazi racial doctrine. This would have been impossible if Jews and Gypsies had been regarded as what they are, as each of them a separate human personality. No, they were not so regarded. Each of these persons was reduced to being merely the illustration of a pejorative label. The word Jew or the word Gypsy was regarded as as a category, and the individual humans, who were, of course, the only realities, were assimilated to this category, were made to be merely illustrations of this bad category, and as such could be exterminated with a perfectly good conscience. I mean, what was being exterminated wasn't really a human being, it was merely the illustration of an idea. And we see the same thing in the communist regime, where what are in fact individual human beings are lumped together merely as illustrations of capitalism, imperialism, cannibalistic bourgeoisie, and so on, and as such are regarded as something subhuman and therefore permissible to destroy. And there is no doubt at all that this tendency is one of the most dangerous ones which we have to face. It is one of the highest prices we have to pay for the inestimable benefit of language, the price of being forced to accept, because we accept the grammar and syntax of our language, being forced to accept bad ideals, bad principles, to accept the idea that whole classes of real individual things are, in fact, merely the expressions of some diabolic principle. After all, one can say that wars really can only be fought if the purely human individuals engaged in wars are disregarded, and the opposite side is simply equated with the concretization of a bad abstraction. I mean, this is in fact what all war propaganda is making people on our side believe that people on the other side are merely the concretization of very bad abstractions. I think the democratic countries don't go quite as far as the other ones have done, but it remains an appalling danger that there is this terrible possibility of this most marvelous of all our gifts, the gift of language, being used in an absolutely diabolic manner to perform mischief on a gigantic scale. Now, let us briefly consider the dangers on an intellectual level of having a wrong form of order and meaning in the world. As it happens, a few years ago, I became very interested in the history of what used to be called animal magnetism and then was later called hypnosis. And when one examines the history of this very strange subject during the 19th century, one is absolutely flabbergasted by the attitude of official medicine and to some extent official science in general towards the subject, because the Victorian Weltanschauung had taken a certain form, because the urge to order and meaning had stressed the fact that material objects were somehow much more real than psychological events. It was quite impossible for most medical men to behave in any kind of scientific or even rational way towards the phenomena of animal magnetism and hypnosis. They completely ignored the fact, for example, that under hypnotic anesthesia, before the invention of chloroform and ether, and before the invention of aseptic surgery and of antiseptics, they completely ignored the fact that the death rate under hypnotic anesthesia was only 5%, whereas the death rate in the conventional medical practice was 29%. One would have thought that this would have made doctors sit up and take a certain amount of notice, but the only notice they took was to hound the people who practiced hypnotic anesthesia out of the profession and persecute them in every system. This system of order and meaning, which had been developed in the past century or two, and could not escape from it. And undoubtedly, the future will show that there are plenty of semantic prisons in which we are confined today, which do not permit us to think straight about all kinds of very important subjects. This will undoubtedly be perfectly clear to the historians 100 years from now. It is not clear to us what these prisons are, but we can be quite sure that there are plenty of them. And again, this is one of the tragic prices that we have to pay for this extraordinary gift of language, this power of symbolization. Well, I shall have to continue this discussion of the symbols in their relationship to immediate experience in the lectures which follow, which will play an important part in any discussion of art and in any discussion of religion. It must play a very important part. And for this reason, I shan't go into the question any further here, but shall leave the further discussion of the subject to the later lectures. Thank you.